Leadership isn't just about strategy. It's about connection. And that's what we explore here on the Tactical Empathy Podcast. I also explore it every week in my newsletter, The E in the Room. With more than 1,000 subscribers already learning how to communicate with confidence and lead with empathy, this is your chance to join in. Head on over to www.erinthorp.ca/resources right now and download a series of free leadership tools and get the newsletter delivered to your inbox. The conversation doesn't end here on the podcast, so make sure you're a part of it. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Tactical Empathy. I am excited and a bit, I don't know if it's grief or sad, but there is definitely a lot of emotion here today as I sit down to record the fourth part of our four-part series on restoring capacity. I think this is a particularly tender topic for me because it feels like a big part of my own journey and my life's work. And so I hope you have found these episodes helpful and supportive and some useful nuggets in there. So this is our final episode. This is part four of four on restoring capacity and overcoming burnout. If you have missed any of the first three episodes, please go back and listen to them. Each episode builds on the next one. So now would be a good time to pause, go back, listen to part one, and you make your way back here to part four. We're also so interesting, but we're also coming up on our 100th episode of the podcast. And so before I dive into today's topic, I would just like to put an invitation out to solicit ideas for topics. So if there's something that you have been curious about or a question that you have had for me, please reach out. You can find my email in the show notes. You can reach out on any of the social platforms in my DMs and just let me know what you're thinking about and what questions you might have. All right, so back to our series on restoring capacity and overcoming burnout. In part one, we talked a lot about body work, so working with our physical body. In part two, we talked about emotional expression. And in part three, we talked about creative expression. And we really looked at all three of these aspects as a way to complete the stress cycle, to restore our capacity, but also to bring back a little bit of empathy. And this whole series was sparked by a conversation that I had with a good friend over the Christmas holidays. And she just said, you know, I feel like I don't have any empathy left for anyone else in the world. And it really got me thinking about why that might be and what have I learned and what could I share with you all in case you were feeling the same way. So today is part four and today we're talking about rest. And if you have been in my world for any amount of time, you know that this is a topic that I love to dig into. And I'm not going to talk about earned rest. I'm not going to talk about how much you have to do before you can take a break. I'm not going to talk about how to optimize it or biohack it. And I'm definitely not going to talk about rest as a reward for being productive, because that is not what rest is. And that was my relationship with rest. And if I'm really being honest with you, it is where I default to when I am feeling overwhelmed, at my limit, with no capacity. I go back to this bad habit of feeling like I need to earn my rest. So real rest is the kind of rest that allows our nervous system to downshift and we actually are in our rest and digest mode. We feel safe, not necessarily physically safe, but we have let down our guard against life and the world. And we've allowed that self-critical voice in our head to quiet. So for many of us, especially for those of us that feel and carry a large amount of responsibility or have big ambitions and dreams, maybe you care for a team at work and a team at home, rest can feel very uncomfortable and very unsafe. It feels like if you take a break, everything around you is going to fall apart. And I say that with all the love in my heart, because I definitely felt like that for a lot of years. And I'll be really honest with you. when I take a break, sometimes some things do fall apart. It's nothing that can't be put back together again. It's nothing world-ending or detrimental. And I think that is the discomfort that I have had to learn to live with. We are culturally tied and conditioned to believe and to buy into this narrative that our value is tied to how much we produce, how much we give, and how much we carry. And so rest feels like we're falling behind, we're letting someone down, it's a weakness, it's a character flaw, and I'm not living up to my potential. And here's the truth. Those feelings of burnout, those feelings of overwhelm, they don't happen because we didn't take enough time at the end of the project or the end of, you know, the year or the end of the school year or the end of the month. They happen because we never actually learned how to rest along the way. Life is a marathon, my friends. It's the marathon that you didn't even know you were signed up for. And so imagine if you actually were in a physical marathon and you never stopped to fuel your body or have a drink of water, you probably wouldn't finish it. There's very few humans that could finish that. And those that could finish it have been training for years to build their capacity. So I've referenced the book Burnout throughout this series. It's been a huge resource for me. Emily and Amelia Nagoski are the authors. And it was the first time that this sensation of burnout and overwhelm and constant vigilance was described to me in a way that I could understand. And they explain that stress is a physiological process, that if we never send the signals of safety to our body, if we never allow our body to complete the stress cycle, then we remain constantly braced for the worst. Our nervous system stays on high alert, even though we may be watching Netflix or having a sleep or out walking with a friend, we are on high alert. And so true rest is one of the clearest signals of safety we can give our nervous system. But for many of us, it is the biggest mountain we need to climb. And I will tell you that rest has been my personal mountain that I have been climbing for the last 10 years. And when I say mountain, I mean mountain. I live an hour away from the Rocky Mountains, big, jagged, sharp, huge mountains. This is what rest has felt like for me in my life. And when I first started doing my own deep work, therapy, coaching, really recognizing my own patterns, rest kept coming up and it felt impossible. It felt like I just couldn't do it. I wasn't wired for it. It was not a part of my identity. I certainly had no muscles around it at all. And sitting with myself was probably one of the most unbearable things that I had to do. If I wasn't moving, producing, problem solving, helping, fixing, I actually now know that I felt anxious. But back then, I didn't know that that's what anxiety was. I just thought it was how I was wired, that I was a producer, a mover, a go-getter, a constant source of energy. But what I have come to realize is that movement wasn't driven from a place of fulfillment or capacity. It was actually driven by anxiety. I felt untethered and highly exposed and very vulnerable, and I just needed to do something to make that feeling go away. And so my therapist at the time, this was probably 10-ish years ago, suggested something very simple. She first gave me the assignment to spend an hour or two alone once a week by myself. Now, at this time, I had very little kids. You know, they were like 6, 8, and 11. I think I have their ages wrong, but that's neither here nor there. They were in that range. So alone time was pretty foreign to me at that point. And so I had the conversation with my husband and, you know, he was like, yeah, absolutely. Take a night. So we decided Friday nights was the easiest night for me to take a couple of hours away from the family. And I remember the first few weeks, I had no idea what to do with myself. I ended up with a Starbucks at the grocery store, wandering the aisles because it was the place I felt safe. And I could, you know, pick up the few things we might need for the weekend. I convinced myself that it was leisurely, that I was resting, but all the while I was still managing the shopping list, managing the to-dos, picking up the little things, doing the errands. Sure, I had space to do that and it felt great, but it was still productive movement, right? I was still carrying the mental load of the family. I wasn't alone. I wasn't resting. And so I came back after the first few weeks and checked in and, you know, told her what I was doing. And she goes, yeah, that's not resting. I'm like, yeah, but I don't know what else to do. Like, I don't know what to do. And so it was at that moment that she suggested floating. And it was an hour. And, you know, it took me about 20 minutes to drive to the studio, an hour to float, and about 20 minutes to drive home. So it fit within the 2-hour time frame that I had given myself. And I was like, okay, well, what is this going to do? Like, how is this going to be supportive? I don't understand. Here's the thing. It was an hour with no phone, no expectations, nothing to pick up, nothing to do, no one bugging me, no one dinging my phone, sending me a text, no errands to run. And it was structured enough that I could tolerate being there. Because here's what happens when we're building capacity. We don't have strong muscles. Floating was just confronting enough for me to stretch into it, to spend an hour off the grid, so to speak, with nothing but me, myself, and I, and my thoughts. Nowhere to go, no one to perform, no productivity to check off, no checklists, no task lists, no nothing. And this was truly my beginning, the beginning of my relationship with rest. And not as like a wall I hit and I collapsed and I had a breakdown and needed to kind of rebuild, but it was my first experience with rest in a really present and I would say almost, you know, healthy way. So it was the first time and the first few times that I floated, I slept. I'll be really honest with you. You know, it's not a lot of water. You're not going to drown. It's actually really hard to sink yourself in a float tank. But it was quiet and dark and I had nothing else to do. And it was the first time my body could actually let down its guard and give me what it needed. And that was sleep. It was restorative. It wasn't guilt-ridden. I wasn't like I was having a nap on the couch while the kids were around me and there was a million things to do in the house. I was actually doing something by going and floating and giving myself a break. And so, yes, it felt uncomfortable. Yes, it felt restorative. And I think this is the thing, you know, the thing we want is on the other side of that discomfort. If you truly want to build a relationship with rest and feel nourished, you know, nourished was a word that nourished was a word that kept coming up for me over and over and over again as I worked with Daniel Laporte's framework of core desired feelings. And the funny thing about feeling nourished is you actually have to give yourself a break. You have to learn this relationship with rest. You can't stay on the treadmill of productivity and overwhelm and high alert and feel nourished because you will eventually run out of resources. You have to take time to replenish your resources. And so this floating experiment was the first of many over the last decade that has allowed me to lean into the practice of rest. Fast forward a few years. This was probably about 3-4 years ago now. I was gifted the book Sacred Rest by Dr. Sandra Dalton Smith. And again, very serendipitous, she talks about 7 types of rest that we need. And I will say that I was definitely in the category of thinking rest was mainly in the bucket of physical rest, where if I just sat down and didn't do anything, I would feel rested. But I am somebody who does sleep well, thank goodness, because I don't know what I would do if I didn't. But I regularly get between 7 and 9 hours of sleep a day, and I still feel exhausted. And so I was like, why is this? And it's because sleep is only one type of rest. So according to the book by Dalton Smith, there are 7 types of rest that we need. Physical rest, which pretty obvious: sleep, naps, stillness, resting our physical body. Which, to be quite honest, if you work in an office job, you probably have way too much physical rest. To be really honest, your body's probably very sedentary. And so physical rest might not be the thing you need. And this was what I discovered. Then there's mental rest, right? The constant problem solving, the decision making, the mental load of carrying a family, a team, a job, a career, a business. This was a big bucket for me. And that's what floating gave me. It gave me a time to set that down. I could turn off my brain. The third one was sensory rest, right? Reducing noise, screens, notifications, constant stimulation. If you live in a house with three small children, sensory rest is hard to come by, especially with all of the devices dinging and binging us and all of the things going on in the world, TVs, screens. So again, floating really checked that box of sensory rest for me. And I think that these are kind of the two biggest buckets that I didn't even know existed that were really causing a lot of my symptoms around feeling on constant alert and constant need to produce. It was that I could never turn my brain off and I was constantly being stimulated. That's the word I'm looking for. The fourth bucket is creative rest. So this is really, we talked about this in part three, so I'm not going to dive into that much here. Fifth is emotional rest. So again, we talked about that in part two, really creating that ability to be authentic, not perform and express what we need. Now, social rest. Social rest is an interesting one, and it's something that I've really been paying attention to for the last few years. So this is time away from relationships that require effort. So if you think about the number of relationships you have in your life currently, personal, professional, all of the above, the ones that feel effortless, that you feel fulfilled and energized from, are the ones that you keep going back to. But the relationships that feel a little bit draining, require a little bit extra effort, those are the ones that you really have to watch how much time you put into and spend with, because otherwise you are giving more than you are getting from that social interaction. And again, it's not about balance, but it is about recognizing where your capacity is. Do you have energy to give, or do you need to refill that bucket? And the last one is spiritual rest. So this can be anything from a religious practice to a spiritual practice, to connecting to the source. This could be grounding, spending time in nature. For me, I love being by the ocean and I love being in the mountains. And for me, that's where I feel the most spiritually connected. And so really getting time in those places in my life helps me reconnect. And so when I look back over the last decade, I can see how far I've come and how I've slowly integrated a lot of these forms of rest into my life. Some of the other practices that I go to that we haven't talked about yet in this series, I've mentioned floating a lot in this series. Recently, probably in the last 4 years or so, I've done a lot of hydrotherapy. So this is moving between hot and cold. Again, forced disconnection, because you are literally in a sauna or a cold pool. So you get that sensory rest. The cold and hot also forces you to put down the mental load, because in order to sit in a cold pool for a few minutes, you have to focus on being in the cold pool. So what I love about hydrotherapy is it brings me right back to the present. And I can't be anywhere else. So mental rest, spiritual rest, because usually I'm doing it in beautiful locations, which I'm very fortunate enough to do, but you can do it in your shower and your bathtub, which I have done at home. It's about bringing you into the presence, a little bit of physical rest, sensory rest, mental rest, sometimes emotional rest, because we do have some expressions. But what this does is it pulls you out of your mind and back into your body. I also regularly am not in the same room as my phone. I charge it in a different room. I sleep with it in a different room. I forget where it is in the house often. And again, I have no notifications turned on. It goes to sleep at 7 p.m., doesn't wake up until 9 a.m. And this is really to protect my sensory, my stimulation, my sensory rest. So the, you know, really looking at my relationship with my phone has really helped quiet the noise, reduce comparison. And I'll regularly delete all my social media apps, all the games. My kids think my phone is quite boring right now because all I have on it literally are the weather, the phone, the email. That's it. There's nothing else to do on my phone. And it is amazing when you delete your social media apps or your games and you notice how often you go to pick up the phone and check those things. Again, just a good reminder. The other thing I've done with my phone is, and that I had to adjust the parental controls for one of my children here, well, all of the kids over the years, but most recently, and I was thinking, you know, why don't I do this for myself, like set some app time limits? And so I have. Social media, I get 30 minutes a day. And some days I go over that if we're doing something or I'm posting or whatever. But most of the time it's 30 minutes a day. And when it comes up and reminds me, I'm like, oh gosh. And sometimes that happens like before 9 a.m. and other times I don't hit it until 9 p.m. But again, it's just that reminder. And then you have to constantly, consciously choose, are you going to go over it or not? So lots of ways we can interact with that. The other thing I alluded to was time in nature. For me, is a bit of creative and spiritual rest. I love the mountains. I love being in the forest. I love being by the water. But it really helps me again come into the presence. So I share all of this with you because 10 years ago, my relationship with rest felt like failure. It felt like I wasn't strong enough, disciplined enough. I didn't have what it took, the mental fortitude to be productive and turned on all the time. And I am happy to report that a decade later, that perspective has shifted completely. And now I understand that rest is maintenance. I don't rest so that I can do more. I rest now so I can be who I want to be. I can feel the way I want to feel. I can be the leader I want to be. I can be the wife I want to be. I can be the mom I want to be. I can run the business I want to have. And rest 100% protects my capacity to show up in this world the way that I want to show up in this world. And it allows me to practice empathy the way I want to practice it. Because when I'm rested, I am more patient. When I'm rested, I'm less reactive. And when I'm rested, I'm more discerning and less judgmental. So for me, rest is not indulgent anymore. It is infrastructure and support for the life that I want to build and lead. And without it, this work would become heavy and I probably would have burnt out a long, long time ago. So here is the important reframe that I want you to leave with. Rest is not giving up. It's not falling behind and it's not starting over. It's intentionally hitting pause and refilling your resources so that you can continue with honesty and integrity. It's allowing your nervous system to recalibrate so you don't spill your depletion and your fears and your worries and your dysregulation all over the people you love or lead. And most importantly, rest is completing the stress cycle before it turns into resentment, numbness, or disconnection. Burnout is not a personal failure. It's a physiological and emotional signal that the stress cycles in your life have not been completed. Your capacity has been stretched and you have not taken the time to recover. So I hope that this four-part series on bodywork, emotional expression, creative expression, and rest helps you figure out where to start rebuilding your capacity, because empathy isn't something you lose because you're broken. Your capacity is diminished and it will recover when the conditions allow and you have taken the time to rebuild your capacity. If you have found this series to be helpful, I invite you to share it with someone you love or lead who might be questioning whether they have the capacity to continue on or wondering if their empathy might be gone for good. If you haven't already left us a rating or review, wherever you listen to your podcasts. I would love for you to do that. It is one of the simplest ways to support this work and help us reach everyone who needs to hear this message. And again, as we approach our 100th episode here on Tactical Empathy, I invite you to let me know what you want to hear more of or what questions you have. Empathy is not an endless resource, but it is a renewable one. It requires care and boundaries and self-compassion. And I would love nothing more than to hear how this series has impacted you. So please reach out either by email, website, or on social media. Let me know what's resonated with you, maybe what's surprised you, and what are you taking with you and going to try to implement. Please keep practicing. Please pay attention to the signs and signals and know that I am in your corner rooting for you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for practicing tactical empathy.